The J-Talk Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. Ben Maxwell and Sam Robson with you. And Sam, we usually like to start our episodes in an upbeat manner, but it's with heavy hearts we begin this week after the tragic passing of the Shonan Belmari midfielder Riula, who died last week at the age of just 23. An unexpected and terrible loss for everyone associated with Belmari and the wider J-League community. A young man taken far too young.
Yeah, absolutely. It was some shocking news, really, when I heard it Tuesday night. 23, as you said, it's no age. It's just, yeah, an horrendous thing to happen. I think he was on his own as well. There was no family around him. They're all back in Brazil. So it's just a devastating loss for his family and for everyone at Shonan. So my thoughts go out to them. It's just, yeah, heart condition at 23. It's just horrible. So, yeah, it's hard to really know what to say. Condolences to everyone. And the only thing I would say is there was an interview with Tariq El Yunusi that came out afterwards to Norwegian press, and in that he suggested that nobody had at Shonan had heart screenings at all during medicals. And I thought this was kind of a standard practice, which obviously isn't the case. So if anything does come from this, I'd like to see that kind of as a mandatory thing, because some things could be caught earlier and you might not get as many of these instances. But yeah, it's just a shocking tragedy.
Yes, indeed. So Riula made one league appearance off the bench after joining Shonan in October 2020. That was one appearance last season, and he made two league appearances, including one start in June this year, but was a fringe player at Belmari. But Sam, he played a lot for Belmari in the League Cup. He started all six of their group stage games this season, and indeed the first game of the playoff stage against FC Tokyo. So, he'd been getting some run in the League Cup. Was he the sort of player you could see maybe latching on and becoming a more important member of the squad in the coming years?
Potentially. Obviously, he was very young. He was still adapting to the country, adapting to the league, adapting to his teammates. But he's looked pretty decent. He was good on the ball, looked a decent player. I mean, it's hard to say after a couple of League Cup games where he was going to go, because he didn't really get a chance in the league. But yeah, he seemed decent, and everything that's been said about him from teammates have just said what a wonderful person he was. So yeah, it's a real loss to the J-League that we don't get to see a bit more of him.
Yes, indeed. Riula lost to us at the age of just 23. May he rest in peace. So it was with obviously very heavy hearts that Riula's teammates then took to the pitch on Saturday afternoon against Tokushima. And joining us to talk about that game and some of the others from J1 Matchday 37 is Alan Gibson from J Soccer Magazine. Alan, a somber beginning to this week's episode, but it's always great to have you back on the podcast. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. And thanks to Sam for those kind words. I think he summed it up, and one of the few times I've been speechless, really. So it's indeed a sad occasion. So thank you, Sam, for those that very nice summing up there.
Well said, Alan. Thank you. And Sam as well, of course. So, OK, the show must go on, and it obviously did for Shonan on Saturday afternoon. But having to front up after the death of a teammate, it must have been a massive understatement to say a very difficult game for the squad to play. And it's such an important one, obviously, so late in the season. And their visitors on Saturday afternoon were the team trying to stay above water themselves in J1 in Tokushima Vortis. This was the very definition of a relegation six-pointer, Sam. So, the Shonan players having to play after this horrible news in the week. And, Tokushima have turned up and, given them a good game and ended up winning a crucial 3 points with Takeru Kishimoto netting the winner midway through the second half.
Yeah, I mean, it was such a difficult occasion. You could see the emotion on the Shonan players after the minute silence at the start. And I mean, I don't really know how they managed to play this game at all, to be honest. I've got to give them a lot of credit. It was a tight game. It was tense. Like, it was kind of as you would expect. But maybe Tokushima, I think, did edge it. They had the better chances. And you can understand why maybe Shonan weren't quite ready for this game. I think Tokushima were professional. Obviously, it's not easy for them to come into this situation either. It's such a weird one. It's not what anyone would be really used to. So I think they played well. The first half was quite scrappy. I mean, occasionally the ball would come close to getting a chance for Tokushima, but nothing really, really happened. And in the end, they took the one chance. It was a great volley from Miyashiro from the corner, and then Kishimoto just reacted quickest, and really Shonan didn't have anything to respond with. They were just kind of not out of the races, quite understandably so. And it's a real shame that, because this game, when we were talking about last week, we were all looking forward to it. It was a big game for the relegation battle, and obviously it's great for Tokushima that they've won, but yeah, it's the circumstances really took away from the occasion.
Yes, indeed. So, yeah, the very definition of a relegation dogfight, six-pointer, Alan, at the end of the season. These two teams are scrapping to stay in J1 in 2021. And, yeah, obviously a very difficult situation for Shonan late in this week. And then, yeah, as Sam said, also difficult for Tokushima to deal with the situation themselves with an opponent in mourning and, obviously a subdued atmosphere at the Lemon Gas Stadium. But, Tokushima have kept themselves in the hunt. If they had have lost this, it would have been done and dusted. But they've managed to hang on and give themselves a real chance in this weekend's final match day.
Indeed, it was a big win for them, wasn't it? As you say, it must have been very hard. How do you motivate yourselves or even feel that you're taking advantage of a team that are obviously having problems? So, it was in the end, though, there it is. It's a win for Vortis, and they're one of three teams now that are going into the last game. We always have it. You know, there's always extra teams. It's never at the top. It's already gone now, but at the bottom, we've still got three teams in it for the last day. And I presume we're going to talk about it, so I won't go on about the chances now. But Vortis did themselves a huge favour, and I mean, apart from Shonan Bellmare's goal difference, Vortis must be having a little momentum now and be quite confident this week.
Yes, indeed. So, obviously a difficult atmosphere at the Lemon Gas Stadium, but ultimately a terrific 3 points for Tokushima that keeps them well and truly in the running to stay in the top flight for next season. So from there, we'll move over to the Saitama Stadium, where the other big game in the dogfight took place when Urawa Reds hosted Shimizu S-Pulse. And Shimizu were, I guess, at the end of the day, the other big winners from this match day, as they now control their own destiny after a stunning winner from Keita Nakamura in the third minute of second half stoppage time gave S-Pulse a 1-0 away win over Reds. It was a very important week and indeed a match day for Reds as well, as they bade farewell to three club legends in Yuki Abe, Tomoaki Makino and Tomoya Ugajin. But S-Pulse well and truly spoiled their party. I think it was their first win over Reds in the league for more than 8 years, and it could not have come at a better time. And just about a goal of the season contender from Nakamura to do it, Alan. An absolutely remarkable shot from inside the D, as I said, in the 93rd minute when S-Pulse's season was on the line. You could almost make an argument this is the most important goal that an S-Pulse player has scored in the last 10 years or so. It had that much riding on it.
Indeed, that you could see that. I mean, the team, the crowd, the players, they went absolutely crazy. They knew what it meant, even if they didn't know the other results around them. It was one of those, shall we say, speculative shots. You know, he controlled it, but then he didn't have time to lift his foot and, you know, make a blast out of it. So he just sort of poked it towards the goal and it went in the right place. I mean, and he hasn't played. I mean, he hasn't started for about 10 games, this guy. At least I'm sure Sam's probably got the details. But I mean, he played about 8 or 9 games at the start of the season, I think. And then he just hasn't played for quite a while. And then he starts this game and he comes in and as you say, saves Espoirs probably with the most important goal since. We'll let the listeners decide.
Yeah, that's one for the history vault, I think, at Espoirs, and probably a question for Barry Velder to ponder. But yeah, I can't think of a more important one in the past decade or so, or at least in the last 8 years or so that we've been doing this podcast. So Sam, yeah, it was an important game, as I said, for Reds, farewelling those three club legends. But I guess you could tell from this game that Shimizu had a bit more riding on it. They were creating more chances, and Shusaku Nishikawa was called into action a couple of times, is saving from Yuito Suzuki in first half stoppage time, and then from Thiago Santana midway through the second half. And then, he almost punched one in from a corner, didn't he? But to his relief, the ball had skimmed off his gloves, but then came back off the far post and bounced across the face of goal. But at the other end, Sam, Espoirs had not kept a clean sheet in the league since the start of July, but have now kept two in consecutive 1-0 wins. And they might have just about righted the ship at the perfect time. But they did need Shuichi Gonda to make a save at the feet of Koya Yuriki in the 88th minute. But that was just laying the foundations for what was to come from an absolutely stunning goal from Nakamura.
Well, it was a stunning goal. But yeah, you're right to point out the defensive stability that they've had the last couple of games. And I don't think it's any surprise that Yoshinori Suzuki has been back for those two games. He really marshals that defence, and they were quite solid. I thought Reds were very disjointed for much of the game. It's that you're still getting a few of those performances under Rodriguez. Most of the time they've been sublime, but there are these occasions where it doesn't quite work. And Junku was still out, and Koizumi only made an appearance for the second half, so neither of them have caused any, caused us to judge on the Reds player of the year that we were struggling on last week. But yeah, Shimizu, they've played very well last couple of games, got those victories, and they're making a habit of like players out of nowhere stepping up to score vital goals. There was Yuta Taki a couple of weeks ago, and then Nakamura, yeah, he's, as Alan was saying, he's only started once in the league since May, so it's just, yeah, it's not the guy you were expecting to pop up, but what a goal it was from him. And yeah, Shimizu I thought were fantastic again in this game. They were dominant. Nishikawa was the only one stopping this from being 2 or 3-0, and they've got all the momentum going into next week, but probably got the toughest fixture on paper, so it's all to play for.
Yeah, we're just about to round up the situation at the edge of the relegation zone and talk about what's coming up this Saturday. But before we do, before we leave Urawa, we've got a question to ponder from one of our patrons, Gabrielle Anello, who got in touch with a couple of questions for us to muse on this week. So thanks again for your questions, Gab. So on Reds, it's not certain, of course, that they'll miss out on the ACL, because they could still win the Emperor's Cup and qualify through that route. But Gab was wondering if missing the ACL spots would actually open a chance for Urawa to be a title contender in 2022. Alan, do you feel the same as Gab there?
Obviously, we all know that most of our teams, if not all of them, can't handle ACL and the league and the various cups in any given season. So obviously that goes for them, if you can take the cloud and the silver lining. But I'm not sure if Rodriguez is ready to rebuild and bring in 3 or 4 more foreign players. And I know because he's dumping Thomas Deng, for example. And of course, Makino and the other players that you mentioned are all moving on. But I think what he's got going right now is a very good bunch of young players who are getting the time. And I would say lesser known players, because I won't call, for example, Eseko or Hirano that young. But they've never really gotten anywhere with their other clubs before. Shibato, Yuruki, Okubo, Kaneko, Koizumi, Ito, Akimoto. I mean, there's a very good base of players there with a few shall we say, experienced players in, well, presumably the ones that will be there next year will be Sakai and Schultz and Iwanami. So I'm hoping that he doesn't bring in too many new or different players to mess up what he's actually got building quite nicely right now. Your thoughts, Sam?
Yeah, I'm completely with you, to be honest. I think, obviously, if they don't make the ACL, that's great for them. It'll give them well, much more time to make that run. I think the gap is too big to make a title run. I mean, they're 29 points off Frontale. I can't see that being bridged in 1 year. I can't see them being title contenders. And they're still 8 points off Vissel Kobe in third. So, as you say, there are quite a few players going to leave in the winter. It's still, I think, got one more year of rebuilding before he's going to get that squad completely right and completely in a place that can put a genuine title challenge. I think next season, top three, they should definitely be aiming for that. I think that's where they would expect to be. But I think going that one step further to the title, I think next season is maybe one season too early.
But then if they go for top three next season, that means the season after they're in the ACL, and doesn't that hit their championship chances?
It could well do, yes, but it will also help them attract maybe some stronger players. They might be able to get a stronger squad. So, obviously there's pluses and negatives about being in the Champions League, but you always want to be in there. And Frontale have managed it. They've not quite gone as far as they would have wanted in the Champions League, but in the league they've dealt with that, especially the two group stages, which has been a nightmare, that this season, and they've managed to manage it. So, yeah, it will harm them, I suppose, if they do make the Champions League even next season. But yeah, I think top three is where they should be aiming for next year, and hopefully that a team the size of Reds should be able to manage it and should be able to get a squad strong enough to compete on both fronts.
Yes, yeah, I agree with that. I mean, yeah, that's the perfect way of phrasing it, Sam. Yeah, I mean, they are, without question, yeah, one of the biggest clubs and one of the most ambitious clubs in the J-League. And yes, they want to be fighting at the sharp end of all the competitions they're in. So, I agree with both of you, and indeed with the sentiment of Gab's question that, yeah, I think next season, if they have an uninterrupted run at the league, then, yeah, top three is definitely within their grasp. And that would mark a significant amount of progress, obviously, in Ricardo Rodriguez's first couple of years, if he can get them up there in year two of his project. And from there, they'll be, ambitious enough to want to be in the ACL and also challenging at the sharp end of J1. So we shall see. Yeah, I think they've ended up slightly ahead of expectations this year, haven't they, Reds? So there will be that. With that, will come some pressure to kick on in year two under Rodriguez. And yes, they'll be under the microscope, as they usually are, up at Saitama Stadium next season. But yes, when you think of the squad and the first 11 that they can put together, for match day one 2022, I'm sure it'll be getting Reds supporters' mouths watering. Okay, so thanks for that, Gab. And yes, we will be hearing from him again shortly with a question about Cerezo Osaka. But before then, and before we move on to a couple of the other games, let's round up the situation, at the edge of the relegation zone then, after match day 37. So Shimizu's win over Reds has taken them on to 39 points. They have a goal difference of minus 18. They are now 3 points clear of both Shonan and Tokushima. Shonan 36 points minus 5 goal difference, and Tokushima 36 minus 19. So on the final day of the season then, this coming Saturday, when all games kick off at 2 o'clock, these three teams are in action, and two of them are at home. And recent dogfight results, Sam, suggest that might not be that much of an advantage at all. But I'll come to you for your thoughts on these games in just a second. So firstly, Shimizu obviously controlled their fate entirely when they host Cerezo Osaka. If Espols win or draw, they stay up. But because of the goal difference swing that would come if they were to lose, they will go down if they lose to Cerezo, and both Shonan and Tokushima win. So that is very much in play. Shimizu could slip down from 15th to 17th if that were if those permutations were to come to pass. Shonan are away at Gunma Osaka. If Belmare win, they stay up, barring obviously Tokushima also winning against Hiroshima by 15 goals or something like that. Shonan will also stay up if they match or better Tokushima's result. Vortis are at home against Hiroshima, and they will stay up if they better Shonan's result. And all supporters of these three clubs, and indeed all neutrals who love the J-League, will have their eyes on these three games starting at 2 o'clock on Saturday afternoon. So yeah, Sam, I mentioned there the away factor. For active dogfighters in the last couple of weeks, the only team to not win away from home is Oita in the previous match day when they headed up to Kashima and were impotent and their fate was sealed. But yeah, last week, of course, as you will remember, and the listeners probably will as well, Shonan went up to Sendai and sealed their fate. Tokushima rolled over FC Tokyo at Ajinomoto Stadium. And then, yes, this past weekend, Shimizu have gone up to Urawa, and in the six-pointer to end all six-pointers, Tokushima have headed to Shonan and beaten Belmare. So usually we would think home field advantage is just that, an advantage. But for Shimizu at home against Cerezo and Tokushima at home against Hiroshima, obviously there'll be pressure and expectations from the home supporters. Shonan travel to Gunma. So looking across these three games, it's tough to pin you down for a prediction, but that's why you make the big bucks, mate. So how do you think it's going to go on Saturday?
I have no idea. It's curious that you mentioned the away wins there. And I guess you could say that there's less pressure if you're playing away from home. At home, you've got that, the expectation of the crowd, especially I'd say Tokushima would have expectation given they're in good form. They're at home against an Hiroshima side that have not played well for a little while now. I mean, they lost to FC Tokyo this week, so they can't be playing well. So
agreed.
They would probably expect to get the victory, and then maybe, well, obviously it's out of their hands, they could win and go down, but I think there'd be an expectation there of Vortis to win. Shonan playing a Gamba team, you don't really know what you're going to get with that Gamba team, because on paper there's so much quality in that side, but yeah, their performances all season have been below par, so Shonan would go there and think they can get something out of it. And Shimizu, obviously they've had a couple of very good results, but they're playing against a Cerezo team who, if they're not like they're packed up for the season, they're still keeping themselves going for the Emperor's Cup, and they played fantastically this weekend as well, so that's a tough game even though they've got the points advantage. I really don't know. I hope that Shonan aren't carrying over still some effects that they felt this week, and I hope they were able to give a full account of themselves against Gamba. So I don't know. Can I have a pay rise to make this prediction? Because I don't think I'm getting enough. I think it's going to stay as it is, even though I think Tokushima will beat Sanfrecce Hiroshima.
Okay. Yeah, all right then. So, Alan, obviously, a couple of teams from your sphere of influence mentioned here, opponents for Shimizu and for Shonan. So, yeah, I mean, that's a great point from Sam, isn't it? The weekend after this final match day of the season, Cerezo will play Urawa in an Emperor's Cup semi-final. So, yeah, they're certainly not on the beach yet. And, I mean, it'd be... The most amazing J thing to end all amazing J things, wouldn't it? Surely, if Shimizu went from 3 points clear of the drop zone at the start of the match day to relegated after it, I mean, that would just surely take the cake, wouldn't it?
I guess that's going to happen then. Yeah. I do see Shonan Belmare winning. They are managed by Satoshi Yamaguchi, who is a longtime servant of Gamba Osaka, including their under-23 manager for a long time and the assistant coach to Miyamoto. So there might be something going on under the table there, you know. Also, it should be noted for those listening that it might matter too. Of course, Etani is on loan from Gamba, so won't be able to play in this game. So Belmare are losing their main keeper for this game too. I got the feeling that, well, you know, what we've seen from Gamba so far this season, it's been a very up and down, but mostly down. They're safe. They've got nothing to play for. I can't see you know, caring about Yamaguchi too much, but they may care about the Ryula situation, and they might be affected by that too. You know, sending the team down that have lost a player so in such bad circumstances. Belmare are up for it. I like them. They play well. They have some very good players. Wellington could be a match winner. I like that guy in particular. And I feel that Vortis against San Freche, it's a good chance for a home win as well. Espols Cerezo, yes, as you say, it could be down to that. I'm sure Espols can play at least they can get a draw out of this. So poor Vortis will get the win and Belmare will get the win, but Espols will manage a draw, and perhaps as Sam said, it's, to me, it's looking like it's going to stay the same, and Vortis with their minus 19 goal difference doesn't help either. I guess along with lots of neutrals now because of the situation, I'm rooting for Shonan Belmare, but for different reasons because of people I know there, and in particular Yamaguchi, the manager. So, yep, I think it's Vortis. There you go. Do I get the big bucks?
Yes, you've stuck your neck out, Alan. So, yeah, the check's in the mail. No worries at all about that. Yeah, we appreciate your thoughts there. And, goodness knows, Chaos Energy J-League, it's amazing, Jay, all over. And, I can't wait for Saturday. And it's going to be nail-biting stuff, I'm sure, across those three games that have so much riding on them. Obviously, there was the prospect of a lot riding on the Vissel Kobe's final game of the season, Alan, as we segue up towards the top of the table. As we mentioned in last week's episode, there was, of course, the chance that Kobe could be in the running for second spot in the league in the final match day if they had have beaten incumbents in second, Yokohama F. Marinos, at home on Saturday afternoon, and then taking care of business in their own final league game, with, of course, F. Marinos hosting the champions Kawasaki on the final day. But unfortunately, Alan, Kobe's terrific late surge at the end of the season hit a bit of a road bump on Saturday afternoon, and the frustrating thing, I'm sure, for everyone associated with Vissel is that the first goal scored by Daizen Maeda, his 22nd league goal of the season, was wholly avoidable and came about after some slapshot defending and confusion between Thomas Vermaelen and Gotoku Sakai, the defenders, and their goalkeeper Hiroki Ikura, a goal that should have been easily avoided, and the situation that should have been taken care of. But Daizen Maeda, as we've come to expect this season, is always seems to be in the right spot at the right time, and he stole in to give F. Marinos their lead.
You can call it the luckiest goal in the world, or you can pick Mr. Maeda and say that, you know, he's in the right place at the right time, and that's because he sees it happening. You can see it. I mean, you don't give up on a ball like that, even if there's two defenders in your way. And it was definitely Thomas Vermaelen, who is experienced as captain of this country and a Premier League team. You do not leave it for the goalkeeper if the goalkeeper didn't call. And I'm pretty sure Ikura wasn't calling for that ball. In my time coaching six-year-olds or playing in my own team at centre-back or sweeper, and if somebody shouts for the keeper, I give them a rollicking, because you don't shout for the keeper. The keeper shouts for you. And Vermaelen left the ball. He pointed at Ikura as if to come on, come on. And then he realised he wasn't coming. It was too late. Maeda saw the gap. He got in there. He managed to get the smallest of touches. If he got a good foot on it and whacked a shot, it probably would have hit Ikura. But he didn't. He managed to just, you know, get a little deflection on it. It rolled into the goal. So all great for Maeda, bad for the Vissel defence. It was, you know, I'm not sure if you want me to expand too much on what I was seeing, but Vissel Kobe, I'm Sam might have the stats too, but it seemed to me like Vissel had about 70% of the ball for that game. But Marinos, as we well know, were just lightning. When they attacked, they managed to get fast in number and do things with it. When Vissel Kobe had the ball for the 70% or whatever it was, they did very little with it. And as I've seen so many times this season, no one really wants to take a risk. I saw it with Nagoya Grampus against Gamba the week before too, where Gamba had such a huge amount of the ball and looked like they were going to win that game quite easily. And every time they lost the ball 70 yards up the field, Soma and Kakitani and Maeda, another Maeda, Naoki, were just running full pelt towards the goal with nothing else in mind except getting the ball up there. And Vissel Kobe don't do that. They've got Iniesta in the middle there, who is absolutely magic, as we saw three or four times in the second half in particular. But, you know, he's not one of these players who will... Well, if you look at the sprinting stats, I think Iniesta is probably on zero for the whole season. There is no speed of foot from that man, even if there is speed of brain. And Vissel Kobe could do with, you know, some lightning speed. Of course, Furuhashi is long gone now. And when Furuhashi was there, the balls from Samper and Iniesta through to Furuhashi were the ones that made the difference. And Vissel don't just have that now, but Marino showed us that they did.
Yes, indeed. Well, I mean, there you go, Sam. That shows how confusing this situation was, because Alan thought that Vermaelen was calling for Ikeda to come. I thought he was waving him off. And then, yes, Maida has taken advantage of the indecision and given, F. Marino's the lead. I tell you what, we talk about a goal of the season contender from Keita Nakamura in the Urawa Shimizu game. Hotaru Yamaguchi's spectacular volley in first half stoppage time, direct from a real Hatsuse corner, might have taken the honours, I reckon, had it not cannoned back off the bar. But then that man Maida, again, he should really have made the point safe with 15 minutes left after Elber's incredible run from deep in his own half. I mean, he must have covered all of 60 yards before slipping in Maida, who shot past Ikura, but uncharacteristically also past the keeper's left-hand post. But Teruhito Nakagawa wrapped up the points in the 82nd minute with a left-footed curler from just outside the box. There was a late Kobe flurry, but they were unable to break through and are now locked into third spot in the table. So, at the start of the game, obviously, so much promise for Kobe. They were hoping that this would be, coronation is not the right word, but yes, they were hoping that they could join the real elite at the top of J1 here, and as I say, be in with a chance of finishing second at the end of the season. But this game was just beyond them. But I don't know, did you feel they had a little bit of stage fright here, Sam, or was it just that F. Marinoza took a couple of chances better than they did, and it's just one of those days for Kobe?
Yeah, I'm not sure if it was stage fright. I mean, the first half, it was quite tense and quite scrappy, and you know, there was a lot of challenges going in, and neither side really took advantage until that mistake, whoever is to blame. I think Vermaelen has to be to blame. Even if Ikura has called for it, I think Vermaelen should take control of that situation and clear it away. So when after that, I mean, again, the first half, not a lot happened. That volley, I mean, would have been, definitely goal of the season. It was terrific from Yamaguchi. But then with the situation in the game, 1-0 Marinos, they're always going to sit back with the pace that they have on the counter-attack. And they played it really well. They sat deep because Kobe have tried to get the ball, as they did with Furuhashi. And Muto has done that occasionally since he's come in. But he was given no space. So they were trying to play through. Occasionally, Iniesta would just produce a bit of magic to get through a couple of players in put crosses in. They had a couple of chances. I think Lincoln's was probably the best one, where it's nodded back to him, I think by Muto, and he had a free header but hit it straight at the keeper. But yeah, with all the pressure they had, Marinos had that release with Maida. He should have scored one after that terrific run from Elba, but they kept happening a few times, and eventually the goal was going to come for Marinos, because Kobe, Osako wasn't on it. I don't think he missed a couple of chances. Muto missed a couple. And it was just a well-executed game plan, I think, from F. Marinos to hit Kobe on the break. Because at the end of that game, they were quite ragged in the end, Kobe, just desperate for that goal. So I think, credit to F. Marinos. But I don't think this game should take away from the season that Kobe have had, because they have had consistency unlike a Kobe team I've ever seen. And they've got themselves into the top three, they've got themselves into the Champions League, and with all the resources they've got, they should be able to produce a very good squad for next season.
Yeah, most definitely. So that's what we wanted to segue onto and get your thoughts on, Alan. Summing up this Kobe season as a whole, I mean, there'll be obviously some frustration at the two goals conceded and, maybe failing to make more of your possession on Saturday. But, overall, Kobe are locked in now to third spot in the table, sealing by far the highest league position in J1 history for the club. And yes, a qualification to the ACL for the second time in Vissel's history, but for the first time ever sealed through league placing. So that is a terrific achievement. Some would say that is just about par for Vissel, considering the amount of money that Mr. Mikitani and Rakuten have pumped in. And as Sean Carroll made an interesting observation last week, I mean, I mentioned the Galactico project, and Sean said that, I mean, it's clearly changed to a more Japanese player Galactico ideal than your Lucas Podolskis or your David Villas. Obviously, Iniesta is still there, and Vermaelen, whether he qualifies as a Galactico or not, I guess is up for debate. Yeah, probably took some gloss off his reputation with that first F. Marino's goal on Saturday. But nevertheless, as you say, he's captained his country. He is a big name in the game. So do you see that sort of that policy continuing into next year now that the ACL is wrapped up? Will they go looking for more big-name Japanese players who might be open to returning from Europe or to transfer from some of the other bigger clubs in J1 to have a proper crack at the ACL? Because obviously last season, with all the upheaval, Kobe did make it further in the ACL than any of the other J1 combatants. So, as you wrap up this season and look ahead to next year, obviously things are looking just about as rosy as they ever have in Kobe's history.
I think the key point is that manager Atsuhiro Miura, who ironically, I believe, didn't really want to be a manager. He's basically the head of the scouting department and development, etc. And just like Matsunami at Gamba, for example, took over when a manager left. And he stayed in the job, and he's been given another year already, which is, you know, unusual for Mikitani, who probably had his eyes on, I don't know, somebody with a big name, probably approached Xavi without telling us. But Miura's got the job, so now he knows the players well. I think the key point is that Vissel, I look like they're going to keep Douglas. They've got Lincoln, who has a lot of potential. Had some injuries, particular about 2.5 months off with a hamstring problem, but he looks quite a reasonable player. He's still young, and Iniesta is probably going to do at least another year, right? Another crack at the ACL. And Samper has grown immensely, in my opinion. I mean, I thought he was a bit of a hacker 2 years ago. He might still be a hacker, but that's what's missing from some of our Japanese teams, as we've discussed many times before, a bit of dirtiness in the middle. He's definitely become a better player all round. So, and of course they signed Krichic, who sort of counts as Spanish. He might even have a passport, I'm not sure, but he's a Barcelona connection, so I'm not sure they've given up on the Spanish connection as such. But I guess Osako and Muto probably count as Galacticos as well, because, as you say, they're stars. I think it's just coincidence, perhaps, that they became available. It was also rumoured that Vissel Kobe went for Nagatomo and were interested in Sakai Hiroki, which a good Japanese team should always be looking at, you know, current internationals. So I think the possibility of getting Japanese internationals into the team is probably only because they're pretty much full of the foreigners already. There's a rumour, I don't know how much of it is true, that Maekawa may be, I don't know, not necessarily the first team goalkeeper next year, even though this year he settled in, like he even made the Japan squad. Then he had an injury, which was pretty bad for a couple of months, and then he came back. But Ikura, as you say, was in goal, and Vissel Kobe were doing very well. You don't change a winning team. So Ikura made very few of his Ikura-like mistakes this season. But I'm not sure they want to keep him for number one next year either. So the rumours I've heard are that they're interested in Gonda. And I heard I thought ridiculous rumor that they were going to go for Higashiguchi of Gamba Osaka, which I thought that's dumb. And then I thought, well, you know, if Gamba bring Tani back from Belmare next season, and Higashiguchi was going to share the season, perhaps maybe a year in the ACL for Higashiguchi's experience could be good. But I'm just talking through my hat and from a rumor. I didn't hear it from the club. This was just some, you know, some Twitter somebody said and asked me something, and I thought, don't be stupid. But you know, thinking about it, it's quite a possibility. I would like Mike Auer to get his chance. And I think that he has the potential to be called back into the Japan national team. Gonda, if S-Pulse get relegated, it could change everything. You know, Gonda, I think he's on loan from Portimonense in Portugal, and obviously he's the national team goalkeeper. So I don't think that the national team would be interested in a goalkeeper playing in J2. And I don't think if he goes back to Portimonense, who also have Kosuke Nakamura on the bench, he's not even on the bench. So I don't think he's going to get time there either. So if S-Pulse do get relegated, this might all come true. But at the moment, I think, to get back to Sean's point, is that I think the Japanese Galacticos have come sort of coincidentally. If Vissel Kobe went out and aimed for Wataru Endo, maybe brought back Yoshida Maeda, perhaps Tanaka Ao was having a rough time in Bundesliga 2, although he's actually on loan, so he still belongs to Frontale. But if they took the players that are currently upcoming and established in the national team, Morita, even Mitoma, there's no chance he's coming back. But if they'd approached these players, they are the logical ones for a team that wants to be bigger and better. So I'm open to anything at the moment. I'm not sure we need more Spanish players unless they're classy ones, you know, not in the ends of their career, but in the prime of their life. And will they come? So if the Japanese teams can't attract the 26, 27-year-old players who are playing for their national teams because they want to play in the Premier League and then they want to play in the lesser leagues like Serie A. Did I say that? Sorry. The lesser leagues in Europe, and then they have the Brazilian top team, and then they have the Arab money. You know, in the end, most of the foreigners that come to Japan, unfortunately for us, are mostly going to be third or fourth rate compared to where they could be playing or in the prime of their not in the prime of their career. Vissel will have to look for these national team players if they want to improve that side of their squad. I think I rambled on a lot, but Sam didn't say much. Anything, Sam?
I agreed with you in terms of I thought it was kind of coincidental that Osako and Muto came, because Kobe had to react to Furuhashi leaving, because I don't think anyone first of all expected Postecoglou to be at Celtic, and then it moved quite quickly that he brought Furuhashi in, so you needed a striker. It happened that Muto and Osako were available, and yeah, Kobe have obviously got the ability to bring those players in. So whether it's and just a ploy just to, they're going to go for Japanese Galacticos, as you say, or not, I don't know. I don't think so, because he brought in Boyan in the summer. There's that Barcelona connection that I don't think he's ever quite going to be able to tame, Mr. Mkhitaryan. I think he's always going to want to form his team into that sort of club. So I do expect those sorts of signings to still be made, alongside maybe some more Japanese players. Because, yeah, I think you're pretty much on the limit of foreign players, especially for the Champions League, where that's an even more tightly constrained. So maybe you'll see a few more Japanese players, but I don't think necessarily it is a concerted effort that is how Kobe are going to approach things in the future.
Yeah, okay then. So, ultimately a disappointing afternoon on Saturday for Vissel, but when they reflect at the end of the season, I'm sure they'll be proud of their efforts. And a third place finish, as we've said, is their best ever in J1, and credit to them for that. And they'll be looking to kick on both in the league and in Asia next year. All right. Well, despite their defeat, Kobe's third placing was confirmed after Saturday. That's because Nagoya, who were the last team that could have usurped them in third, suffered a defeat themselves 2-1 away at Cerezo Osaka. This was the third meeting in recent weeks between these two. Of course, they had met in the Emperor's Cup and also in the Louvain Cup final. And yes, Cerezo got revenge for their League Cup final defeat by coming from behind. So it was Cerezo older boy Yuichiro Kakitani, though, who bicycle kicked in a terrific opener midway through the second half to give Grampus the lead. But Cerezo flipped the game on its head in the last 10 minutes. We mentioned a Yamaguchi's volley in the previous game, in the Kobe game. Well, Naoyuki Fujita's would have given it a run for its money as goal of the season. And, of course, the J-League and their rather foolish own goal rule means that Fujita was actually credited with this goal by the league, even though his spectacular volley hit the bar and then went in off Mitch Langerak. Anywhere else in the world, that's an own goal. But and that's about the 15th time I've used that expression this season. But anyway, there was no doubting Ryuya Nishio's goal to win it for Cerezo with the 3 minutes left. A header from a corner powered in and celebrated with gusto, Sam, as, yes, Cerezo, well, I guess they've won the aggregate 2-1 over Nagoya over the course of these three games. And yes, so the fact that they've won this game 2-1 as well is kind of apt. Grampus obviously got to lift the trophy recently. But yes, Cerezo, a good come from behind win for them. And well, yes, as we've said, they're looking to finish off the season strongly as they're still involved in the Emperor's Cup. So look out, Shimizu, on Saturday. And yes, they're most definitely not playing out the string, are they?
Oh, not at all. I mean, this doesn't quite make up for the cup final defeat, but they're definitely playing very well and they're setting themselves up for that run at the Emperor's Cup at the end of the season. I thought they dominated this game even before Nagoya took the lead. I mean, Okubo had chance after chance to try and add one more goal to his Yoshimita before he retires, but it didn't quite work for him. But Langerak in goal was magnificent. It was one of those games where it didn't look like anything was going to beat him until that a great strike from Fujita and then a bit of fortune that he got with it bouncing off the post and then off Langerak and in. But yeah, I mean, this game kind of had everything because Kakitani scored a worldie and it was just, I couldn't believe what I was seeing, but it was genuine class from him. The touch up, the volley, it was absolutely magnificent. And it just kind of frustrates you that he doesn't do things like that more often because, yeah, I've said enough about Kakitani, but a terrific goal. But Cerezo absolutely deserved it. They dominated the game. Nagoya often retreat into their shell and try and hold on with their defence. And occasionally, well, a lot of the time, that defence really holds out. But Cerezo absolutely banged the door down and were fully deserving of the two goals they scored. And they could have had more if it wasn't for a terrific piece, a terrific goalkeeping display from Langerak.
Yeah, fantastic. So Cerezo actually do have a chance to finish in the top half of the table, Alan, with one game to go. Their goal difference, actually, their goals scored behind Sapporo. They have the same goal difference, but yes, have scored one goal fewer than Sapporo, who occupy 10th in the table. And obviously, yeah, at the start of the season, 10th would not have been a positive result for Cerezo. But yeah, as they're looking to finish off the season strongly, as we've said, in the Emperor's Cup as well. So yes, this was an important win. And we'll move on to the other of Gab Anello's questions here, Alan. And I'll throw this one to you first. It does concern Cerezo. Gab says that they look promising in terms of potential, Cerezo, but it's not clear who's going to be in charge for 2022. Do you have a name which you'd like to see managing them? Gab suggests Kofu's Akira Ito, since many talents have developed under his guidance at Venfore. Is there a name you could you would like to see in charge of Cerezo in 2022?
Yes, definitely. His name is Akio Kofu, who is the current manager of Cerezo Second.
Right.
I think he's done very well. I mean, basically, when the legend of Cerezo Osaka, Mr. Morishima, who is now the president, basically decided that Lotina's Cerezo were too defensive, even though they were the best defense in the league for a couple of years, I think it was. But, I mean, basically, he dumped Lotina because they were too defensive. And brought back some old guy who's been a manager seven times before, I think, who failed miserably. But Kogiku-san has brought the team back to you know, well, as you say, almost into the top half, into a final. They're still in the semifinals of the Emperor's Cup too. And I think they've done very well under him. And the key, I mean, I've met him and spoke to him a few times. Fortunately for me, when I go to Thailand and watch teams in the pre-seasons, they're much more accessible. And of course, we're going back 2 years now because I haven't even been to hardly any away games at all in the last two seasons. But in the four seasons back, I met the guy a few times, and he's very enthusiastic. He's been training the kids. He's been sort of assistant coach and youth coach, and he's been in the organization for quite a while, I think. And he's basically brought Cerezo out of the slump that they were in with players like, well, the forwards, Yamada, Kato, Nakajima started well but hasn't played so much often. He's even given Riki Matsuda a chance, who came from Vanforay Kofu, I think it was, but I'm not sure about him because he was basically brought in from outside. But there are three young forwards who've probably played a lot more than they were expected, because Takagi, even Okubo and Toyokawa have all been quite injured this season too. But the kids up front have done very well. And they obviously, I mean, when they score a goal and they rush to the bench and they, you know, they're hugging the manager, I think that's really cool. And then in the middle, he brought back Inui. I don't know how long he's been at the club, and I wonder if he was there when Inui was there. But Inui was given the captaincy immediately as well, even though Kiyotake was out at the time. So perhaps it was a necessity. But he's had a very strong midfield, at least five players that can be chosen for the four positions that they usually do in the 4-4-2. And they all play for him as well. Sakamoto in particular, we all know and love. And he came from J2, but has really come on, even into the national team squad this season in particular. The one player I'm a bit disappointed in is Jun Nishikawa, who I really had hopes for at the start of this season, but has hardly been given much of a chance, even though he's under this manager who knows him quite well. And I hear that basically he's a bit of a prima donna, or he expects more than he's getting. So he's being sort of taught a lesson right now. So I'm not sure, but I think he's still got to come. I think the key at the back was they brought in Thiago. Shindo came in from Consadole Sapporo. But even with Thiago, who's, as a Brazilian, was expected to play, and you know, he's, you know, we all expect the Brazilians to play more, but Seco is the obvious first choice there. But Nishio has come in alongside Seco more often than Thiago, and again because Nishio and Seco also played under their manager when they were younger. So you know, to cut a long story short, there, I think that the current manager is the one that should keep his job for another year and develop the kids that he's got, with perhaps bringing in a couple more very decent players. Adam Taggart has been very unlucky with injuries. You know him as an Australian, of course. He's got the potential to be a very good scorer in Japanese football, I think, but had problems getting into the country with the COVID regulations. Then he was unfit, then he was injured, and now he's undergone knee surgery. So hopefully he's fine for next February when the season starts. They have Inui, who is sort of looking very good indeed, I think. And then some signing like Riki Harakawa could be the key player, like, for example, Vissel Kobe Yamaguchi took a little while to settle, but then was almost ever present for 2 years, and he's a key player. And I think Harakawa has been in and out of the team a bit, and he's had injuries too. But next season, Harakawa could be a great player too. So I think they've got a good base. Perhaps it's the right back and the left back who are both hitting there. I think Matsuda's probably 30 and Marahashi 32 or thereabouts. So they're not really that old. But there's the likes of Koike, Toriumi, Arai. Even Shindo is not, you know, he's not so old. So they've got some good youth in the squad already, and some good youth coming through. And I think that those guys will play for this manager. So, yeah, to cut a long story short, I think they've already got the manager they need.
Yeah, that's an interesting shout. I don't know if you concur, Sam, but yeah, I mean, Kogiku has, he's definitely steadied the ship. You can't argue that fact since they got rid of Kulpi. And, getting them to the Levain Cup final and into the semi-finals, and, goodness knows what's to come in the Emperor's Cup from there. I guess you never really know whether to stick or twist, do you, when a caretaker manager comes in and does okay towards the end of the season? It would be pretty hard for them to remove Kogiku, I suppose, if he were to go on and win the Emperor's Cup, but that would probably force the club's hand. But, do you think he's made a strong enough case to be kept on for next year?
Yeah, it's always interesting speaking to a United supporter who obviously had their caretaker manager stay on for a while. I can't argue with anything that Alan has said. I think Kogiku has done a very good job in kind of steadying the kind of madness that was brought in by Kulpi. And they've looked very good at the second half of the season. And then, I mean, if he makes one final in the Levain Cup, maybe makes another, maybe even goes on and wins the Emperor's Cup, I think it'll take a brave person to take him out of the job. He's obviously brought in the youth players very well. I think Seko Inicio as a 20-year-old and 21-year-old at the back have been magnificent. So I haven't got any strong feelings to get rid of him. I think he's done very well. As for Akira Ito that Gab mentioned, I mean, it's probably more of a question for the J-Talk Extra Time boys. I know Kofu have done well in J2, but I haven't seen enough or barely any of them this season to make any sort of informed judgment on him. The only name I had in mind, and this isn't my forte, Japanese managers and who should go where, but Go Oiwa hasn't managed to since they're leaving Kashima Antlers, and just thought the setup at Kashima in terms of the way they play and is very similar to the way that Cerezo set up. He also brought through youth players there, so I thought he might have been a reasonable fit if he was. Well, he's not, I think he's working on a coaching basis for the Japan under 18s at the moment, so I'm sure if any club, whether it's Cerezo or anyone else, would want him, then I think there's room to move there. But is he going to be a better solution than Kogiku? I don't know. I think Kogiku probably deserves, the way that they've played this season, I think he deserves the chance to go on into next season, and hopefully they don't make a mistake by that, and hopefully he doesn't then find himself out of his depth and need to be replaced by interim manager again.
Or Kulpi.
Oh, Kulpi. Yeah, he's due another go, isn't he? He's got to go to Gamba first, hasn't he?
Yeah.
And then come back.
But again, Kulpi may. I haven't spoken to him, and I don't know if anybody has discussed it with him, but Kogiku is very much into developing the kids, as far as I know. And like Miura and Matsunami, as I've mentioned, I don't think he was expecting to be thrown in as a Kantoku, as a manager, as such, and he might want to go back to coaching the kids. And if so, I think he would be wonderful if he came in as the assistant to someone like Nishino, which would really throw the cat among the pigeons. You know, an experienced manager given 2 or 3 years to remould a team using the youth and the coach that was already in position. I can't think of any other particularly experienced manager out of a job right now, although I'm sure there are some, and there will be some very soon as well. You know, Hasegawa perhaps, but I think he's already taken elsewhere. But and I think the listeners know how much I do like and respect Nishino. I'm not sure he wants another job as a Kantoku. He's settled in at the JFA in some capacity. A very experienced manager like Nishino, who knows the players, the league, and the area, working with Kogiku would be pretty good. What do you think?
Nishino. I don't know. Yeah, I guess he's got to do the tour of the Kansai clubs as well, does he? So. I don't know. Sam's Oiwa shout wasn't a bad one. Maybe I'd want to freshen things up a little bit and maybe hope some of Oiwa's antlers, the championship DNA, might rub off on some of the players at Cerezo. But it's, it obviously promises to be an interesting off-season there, no question. And thanks for your couple of questions for us this week, Gab. Alan, before we let you go and we wrap up part one, just give me a second here to play the jingle. It's one of the last times we'll be able to do it this year. This week in VAR. This week in VAR. This week. Johnny Nicol had a question about VAR and the way it's run in its first season in J1. Johnny asks, I guess many people had reservations about the rollout of VAR this year. Has it been as bad as you feared? And are there any improvements you'd suggest for next season? Just pardon Sam and myself for a few minutes here, Alan. We're just going to go and grab some popcorn while we listen to your answer.
Yeah, it's been great, and I don't think we can change anything. Okay, next. I think everybody, myself included, did not want a VAR at all because, you know, we're used to the game as it is. Hopefully they won't go to 25-minute halves and half times and 17 subs in the near future so that everybody can do commercials and things on TV. But I think VAR, as if it's used properly, and we will come to the buts later, if it's used properly, VAR is only, you know, it's a fair thing. It's done right. It rights wrongs. It wrongs rights. And it does the thing. I'm getting used to the assistant linesman's delayed flags for offside. I don't like it, but I understand the logic behind it very much so. And it's actually surprisingly fair and good way to do this delayed offsides because obviously the flag goes up and the offside is wrong. The referee's already blown his whistle or the players have seen it and they stop. And then you realize that the offside is wrong. So I'm actually getting used to and agreeing with the delayed offside flags. But the thing that I'm sure everyone in the world of football must agree with is the length of time it takes some VARs to work themselves out. And we've seen, I think one in particular we saw where there was a handball in the area. And then 4 minutes later, we discovered that there was actually an offside, 3 seconds before as well. Why didn't they look at that first? And I've seen that 3 or 4 or 5 times, and I'm sure it's happened in the rest of the world too. So we need to be quicker. We need, in particular on television, but, and I don't know about the various stadiums, but as far as I can see, there aren't that many replays shown in the stadiums, but there aren't that many replays shown on TV. We get, in particular in Japan, in J-League, we get a couple of minutes of the referee with his left hand on his ear and his right hand out there as if he's holding back the elephants coming over the Alps. I think that we should be at least seeing what is going on, what they're discussing, and perhaps, dare I ask the commentators to even put their oar in and say what they think is happening, or at least, you know, show us what's happening. But the problem I have at the moment is I've seen a few times this season, and in particular in the last game that Gamba had, 2 weeks back, at Gamba's second goal against Nagoya Grampus wasn't actually a goal because they lost 3-1. But they said there was an offside, and they didn't look at the VAR. I watched it on TV. They didn't look on TV. They didn't announce anything in the stadium. The referee looked at the flag, and which had been delayed very much so because there had been 5 or 6 passes, and then Patrick had put the ball in the net. And then the flag went up. Okay, so check it. It wasn't checked. And I didn't actually, until about 3 hours ago, I literally tweeted about this, where I actually watched the highlights, and to me, it doesn't look offside. It's so close. It's unbelievable. And then I put a ruler up against the picture and I proved to myself that actually it was onside. But so to me, the key on that one is that it wasn't even looked at, or at least we don't know that it was looked at. So we need more transparency. For example, if that was looked at, perhaps the referee can give us a signal, or the commentators have got the feed to the guys in the caravan outside that can say, yes, they looked at it quickly, which is what we want, right? They looked at it quickly and it was offside. But no, there is little or no communication as to what is actually happening while the VAR is being discussed. Once the VAR is used, I believe in most cases it is being proven to be correct. And if it's correct, it can only be good for the game in the end. But it's just got to be shorter and they've got to be more consistent. And we need to know what's happening, the fans and the TV viewers.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if there's a lot we can add to that. Is there, Sam? You know, the thoughts of a qualified referee there, and we appreciate the question from Johnny. I mean, yeah, our biggest complaint throughout the season is the length of time it's taken. And yeah, transparency is a great word there from Alan, isn't it? We're often left in the dark about what has been looked at and where the line's been drawn and this, that, and the other. And overall, it's been a frustrating season with VAR, I think. As Alan says, I guess more often than not, the correct decision is proven to be made. But, there's a lot of tidying up, I think, that needs to be done before next year.
Yeah, I think with the transparency thing, I know everyone gets sick of when they started drawing the lines in the Premier League for offsides. So I don't want them necessarily to do that while we're watching it. But I think afterwards, when there's a tight call, and there's so many times this season where we've looked and we think, oh, he's definitely onside, and then it's given offside on review. I'd like some proof, really. If they just put the lines up, just to put my mind at rest that they have got the right decision, I think that would definitely help. And just a question for Alan, because one of the things I've thought to speed things up, because the mantra is clear and obvious errors. So my belief is that if it goes to the VAR, that referee there, who is a qualified referee, should be able to look at the video himself, make the decision, and then just tell the referee on the field to give a penalty or to give whatever, rather than the referee then having to come over and look at the same footage himself, and it just takes double the amount of times. If you were refereeing with VAR, would you be happy with someone else making the decision for you on the pitch, as long as you know that guy is going to take the culpability for the decision, it's on him? Or would you want to go over to the monitor and make that decision yourself?
Well, the key point that you made there was who's taking the culpability, especially in Japan. They will want to know who's going to get blamed, and therefore they'll take their time. But yeah, if I'm on the pitch and I've made a clear error that the guy on the monitor knows is wrong, just tell me in my ear and tell me what to give. I'm fine with that. What I actually watched Aston Villa yesterday. I just seen the highlights of an Aston Villa game where the guy was given a red card, and I thought that was a bit hard. And then suddenly the guy was going over to the monitor, and he cancelled the red card, which I thought was unusual and very nice. But what amazed me was the referee was looking at the monitor, and it looked to me as it literally like 2 yards away from the away fans who were abusing him at the same time. Surely they can move the monitors.
Yeah.
Paul, monitor thing is, if you're called over, it's because you've made an error. So you're always going to change your decision. So it just kind of defeats the point. They just do it kind of a show that, oh, yeah, I'm going over. But, yeah, I'm changing my decision because I've been told it's wrong, and to take another look at it.
Yeah, make it shorter. Tell the ref what's wrong, and the referee can say, OK, I've just heard in my little ear here and I'm given a penalty instead. You know, that's the obvious way to do it. You know, don't give the guy a chance to save face a little by looking at the monitor for a minute, or to discuss it as obviously what they're doing. You know, let's talk about it for 90 seconds. You know, no, there's three guys in the control room already that, you know, they've discussed it. Just tell me what to do. I agree. Yes.
All right, then. Thanks, Alan. Thanks, Sam. And thanks for your question, Johnny. This week in VAR. All right, then. So that is just about it for part one on this week's episode. So, Alan, at this point of the pod, we will let you go and get on with the rest of your evening. Not that there's much left of it, as we're hitting about 20 past 11 on Monday night. But, yes, we very much appreciate your return to the pod and, all your thoughts on the games we've chatted about so far, especially Vissel Kobe, of course. You're now your local team. We've avoided chatting about Gumba too much with you on this week's episode for the sake of your blood pressure. But, thanks very much for your time again on this week's episode. And, whether we'll speak again this year, I'm not sure. But, we hope to speak to you again soon.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure, mostly yours.
It almost always is ours, Alan. Yes, of course, you can follow Alan on Twitter at JSoccer Magazine, but I'm sure you're doing that already. Okay, so we're, after an hour, we're halfway through the Matchday 37 fixture. So after a quick hit of music, Sam and I will be back to round up the other five games. All right, welcome back. So carrying on with the match day 37 results, and we'll begin part two at the Kashima Soccer Stadium, where Nagoya's loss, as we mentioned towards the end of part one, meant that Antlers rose up to fourth in the table with their 1-0 win over the visitors Sagan Tosu. And at the end of the day, this could be a huge win and a huge weekend for Antlers. As I said, they moved into fourth, which could lead to an ACL playoff berth if Kawasaki go on to win the Emperor's Cup in mid-December. There was some lovely symmetry in ISA Wada's goal to win this game. It was his 14th of the season, and it came in the 14th minute. Antlers continuing their impressive unbeaten run at the end of the season. Four wins and a draw in their last five, Sam, and it's seen them overtake Grampus and, hold fourth place in their hands going into the final day.
Yeah, thoroughly deserved victory as well. I mean, it was only Park's kind of heroic, because that one-on-one battle he seemed to have with Wada that kept the score down. Kashima were in complete control, I thought, for the entire game, and fully deserved the victory. And at this time, they managed to get the goal that they failed to do so last week. And they'll probably be still kicking themselves over the Oita result, because if they win there, they've still got a chance of third. But I mean, if they finish fourth, Kawasaki is definitely the team you want, the horse you want to be backing in that Emperor's Cup. So they stand a decent chance going into that final game. But yeah, Sendai, they've already drawn with them once this season, I think. So it's not necessarily guaranteed. But yeah, it was a good result. And they've finally had a bit of consistency towards the end of this season, but probably a little bit too late.
Yes, indeed. So, well, we've just spoken about the champions a couple of times there, so we might as well do their result as well next. So Kawasaki played their final home game of the season at Todoroki. Gunma Osaka were the visitors, and an action-packed first 20 minutes ended with the Kawasaki 2-1 up. Leandro opened the scoring in the 7th minute with a cheeky back flick, and then Reo Hatate made it 2-0, and that was inside the first 10 minutes before Takashi Usami halved Gamba's arrears in the 17th minute with a lovely finish over dinking over Junsung Ryong. But then late on, Leandro bagged his brace with his second of the afternoon in the 85th minute, bringing him level with Daizen Maeda in the race for the Golden Boot. Both of those players have 22 goals heading into their head-to-head battle on the final day of the season. And there was some final gloss added deep into second half stoppage time when Shintaro Kurumaya headed in a corner. So 4-1 it finished. We've mentioned that, Gunma have been fairly ordinary, well, pretty much the entire season, Sam, if we're honest. But yes, they haven't been finishing the season all that strongly at all, although, of course, they have sealed their safety in the past month or so. But, just another professional performance from the champions heading into a big derby away at Yokohama on Saturday.
Yeah, it was. I mean, after the first 10 minutes, you were thinking it could be 5 or 6, and looking like Gamba were going to be blown away. They got back into it through a terrific goal from Usami and then defended fairly well, which they haven't done for a long time this season. They kept it tight until the end, but I mean, Kobe and Kawasaki just continue to press and continue to probe, and they are eventually going to get a few more goals as they did in this game, and it was a thoroughly well-deserved victory. Next week, I mean, yeah, not a great deal is riding on that game against Yokohama, but you've got the Golden Boot race, and I think it could well be a bit of a shootout there. Both teams can score goals. I think it will be really open, and I'm really looking forward to that game. It should be a terrific encounter to close the season.
All right. Well, yes, another huge game on the slate in match day 38 is the game they're christening the Patreon Derby. We've mentioned it a few times throughout the season, listeners. There's been a bit of a running battle between a couple of our patrons, Fukuoka supporting Daniel and FC Tokyo supporting Thomas. They've been going back and forth throughout the course of the year. And recent times, Daniel has definitely had the bragging rights, as Fukuoka have been above Tokyo in the table for a number of weeks now. But it does all come down to the meeting of these two sides at Ajinomoto Stadium on the final day of the season, after results in match day 37. For Fukuoka, they played their third straight draw and a fourth in their last five games when they hosted already relegated Sendai. We've mentioned the phrase goal of the season a couple of times in this week's episode, Sam. Jordi Crooks's effort inside the half hour from 25 yards might make it onto some people's short list. An absolutely tremendous hit with his left foot. That had given Avispa the lead. But then a second half, Real Makita Brace looked set to give already relegated Vegalta a late season boost before Takeshi Kanemori struck with 3 minutes left to ultimately earn, I suppose, Fukuoka a point and deny Sendai. While at the Edeon Stadium in Hiroshima, FC Tokyo headed down there and went behind in just the 12th minute when the returning Tsukasa Shiotani volleyed home a corner. But Adailton equalised with a header 13 minutes into the second half. And then, goal of the season contender. Sure, I might as well throw it in here. With 4 minutes left, the substitute Kazuya Konno channeled a former FC Tokyo fan favourite lefty Yohei Otake when he cut in from the right and sent a superb left-footed curler into Takuto Hayashi's far top corner. So, a flash of brilliance from Konno. Crooks's goal for Avispa was arguably as good. So some cracking goals in these two games, Sam. And the Patreon derby on the final day of the season when all the bragging rights are up for grabs.
Yeah, I mean, they were almost identical goals, Crew and Konno. Terrific efforts. And it was good to see Konno back. Obviously, he's been out with injury for most of this season. But when I have seen him play, he looks like a terrific player. There's a touch of the Nakajimas about him. Unfortunately, he's picked up the injury trait as well. But yeah, he can definitely strike a ball. So they both were exciting dead rubbers, I thought. The Hiroshima-Tokyo game, some of the defending from both teams was dreadful, especially for the first goal, Shiotani, given the freedom of the penalty area to score. But Hiroshima weren't much better. And Avispa, both teams kind of changed a few players around, and it was a competitive game. Maybe not quite the quality that you might have been after, but it was a good game for the neutral. And I'm glad that Avispa versus Tokyo in the battle we're all looking to see is going down to the final day, and I won't take sides in this. May the best team win.
Yes, I think that's all we can ask for. From a Tokyo perspective, obviously, he won't be in the job for very long, but it's good to see Shinichi Morishita get at least one win while he's in the dugout at FC Tokyo. And it comes down to the final day, the battle for eighth spot in the league. It's what they'll all be talking about, I'm sure, come Saturday at 2 p.m. All right, and so just before we leave Avispa, Sam, we did have a question from one of our patrons, Daniel Hawkins, who is very familiar in these parts, and obviously has fought a running battle with Thomas this year. And Daniel asks, ahead of the Patreon Derby, with, of course, Tokyo hosting Avispa Fukuoka this coming Saturday, what areas do Avispa need to build upon to continue a great season and finish in eighth position or above in 2022?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think, generally speaking, I've been very impressed with Avispa. I think the goalkeeper has been a lot better than I gave him credit for at the start of the year. Defensively, I don't think there are any issues. It's very solid. And there are enough strikers to chip in with a few goals. So what I'd look for is probably out on the wings. I mean, Jordi Crewe has barely played this season, and maybe it's just a case of using him a bit more. But out on the two sides, there's not much creativity. There aren't many assists, not many goals coming from them. I think Crewe and Kanemori are topping the charts with four goals and two assists each, which really isn't enough in a 4-4-2 where you're asking your wingers to go quite high as well. So I think that's where the areas where they need to look for. They can't just rely on Salomon Son and Shichi as the wing backs being the most creative players. I think they need a little bit more in there, and maybe up front just Again, it might be a case that you just play John Mary a bit more and get goals there. But I think top scorer is on 9, so you really could do with an out-and-out goal scorer getting you 15 goals in a league season if you are to push and challenge up into the top 7 or higher. So, yeah, that's kind of the areas where I'd look to go to. But, yeah, otherwise, I think they've got a solid-looking squad, but just a bit more creativity to have a bit more about them going forward. What about you? What have you seen from this Avispa side?
Yeah, well, I mean, they've been absolutely terrific, haven't they? And we have to acknowledge that first and foremost. Just to, you know, a note of caution and, you know, second-year syndrome, I think it is... It is a thing. It is a beast in J1. We've just seen Oita struggle and end up getting relegated. Whether they got a little bit too comfortable, a little bit complacent, they obviously lost some important players that we spoke about last week after their relegation was confirmed. So, I'd be looking to lock the door if they can keep all of their important players first and foremost. I think that's probably the main thing that they need to take care of in their first order of business once the season ends, is get all their important players locked in for 2022. And then if they can add some creativity on the fringes, literally on the fringes, as you mentioned, with their need for more creativity from the flanks, then that would be beneficial. But I think it's there's some good youth coming through there, and they've obviously got a lot of established veterans who have taken them to heights that I don't think they could have expected. So I think literally just running it back is perhaps a little bit dangerous. They do need to freshen things up a little bit. But yes, if they can lock down their key names early on and then, look to freshen things up elsewhere, then I'm not sure the sky's the limit for Avispa. But yes, I mean, they could make a habit of a top 10 finish in J1 for a few seasons in a row if they can keep this core together. And I'm sure their supporters would be very, very happy with that. Indeed. So thanks very much for your question, Daniel. All right, we've got two more games to wrap up from a match day 37 and two more home wins to talk about. Sapporo defeated Kashiwa Reysol 3-1 at the Sapporo Dome, thanks to a brace from Milan Tucic and a goal from Tsuyoshi Ogashiwa. For Reysol, Cristiano made their deficit 2-1 on the half hour, but Tucic had the last laugh early in the second half. They were his first two league goals for Sapporo. And a friend of the podcast, Jay Borthroyd, bade an emotional farewell to the Sapporo Dome. It was his final home game in a Sapporo shirt. It was obviously announced that he would be leaving the club at the end of the season. And, I think he's already left the country, hasn't he, Jay? So we're wishing him all the best. He came on for a brief cameo here for the final 6 minutes of his final appearance at the Sapporo Dome. So, ultimately, he's done some great work up there, I think, Sam. He's scored some terrific goals. He seemed to have scored quite a few against FC Tokyo as well, which I wasn't all that happy with. But, he was definitely a fan favourite up there, and they'll be sad to see him go. But considering everything that he's been through and being away from his family in the past couple of years, I'm sure he's wrapped to be getting back home.
Yeah, definitely. I think he's been away from his quite young family for the best part of 2 years now with COVID. So you can understand why he wants to get back. And I think he's done very well in Japan. I think he's one of the foreign players that has embraced the country very well. There's obviously a lot of adoration there from the Sapporo supporters. And I think it was the same at Jubilo when he came in. I'll definitely miss him, because when I started on J2, Jubilo were one of my teams, and Bothroyd he signed the day after I started on J2. So he kind of came in at the same time. And there was a kind of weird situation where Jubilo played an Emperor's Cup title against a university team, and that I was watching, and it was quite weird. And like, I was like 3 months into the job or something, and then Jay Bothroyd messaged me on Twitter and like asked me to talk him through the game. So it was quite a surreal moment for me there. So cool. Yeah, I've always liked Bothroyd. I think he's given a lot to the league, so I wish him well if he continues his football somewhere or if he heads into retirement. I hope to see maybe as a coach in the J League in the future.
Yeah, interesting shout. Yeah, well, obviously we're massive fans of him on the pod. Yeah, after his two appearances, and yeah, he's yeah, it was absolutely terrific on those two occasions. And yeah, we I'd certainly echo Sam's thoughts there. Yeah, we wish him all the best. I was thinking that if he was leaving Sapporo, that yeah, he might want to try and catch on maybe with one of the teams that has been relegated down to J2 for next season. But yeah, I can understand that he probably wants to have an extended period of time at home before he decides what his next move is. But yes, Jay Otsukare-sama, for your time with both Iwata and Sapporo. And yeah, I hope we get to speak again someday. So to the final game, and it was played out between two teams whose relegation was already sealed in the previous match day. Oita hosted Yokohama FC, and Trinita won this game 2-0. Yamato Machida opened the scoring in the 8th minute, and then Hideto Takahashi scored a comical own goal past Sven Brodersen from the edge of his own area just before the half hour. So, Sam, you know, this obviously had absolutely nothing at all riding on it, so I won't even come to you for a comment on it. But, yeah, Oita have won this game. So, looking ahead then to the final game of match day of the season, match day 38. We've obviously mentioned the three huge fixtures involving the teams in the still left in the relegation dogfight. Two will stay up from Shimizu Shonan and Tokushima, and it's going to be fascinating to see how it all plays out. We've mentioned the Patreon derby between FC Tokyo and Fukuoka at Ajinomoto Stadium. There are some dead rubbers here, but yeah, there will be a lot of eyes on the Nissan Stadium, of course, Sam, in the battle for the Golden Boot. Maeda versus Leandro both have 22 league goals as they go head-to-head. And obviously, as you said earlier, yeah, F. Marinos versus Kawasaki is always an entertaining watch. And I'm sure it will be again this coming Saturday. But, yeah, also a bit sneaky. But the battle for fourth, obviously, Kashima and Nagoya, one of them has to finish there. Sendai host Kashima Antlers with the Antlers in the box seat to hang on to fourth, while Nagoya host Urawa. I mean, yeah, I won't come to you for a pick of the weekend, Sam, because there's those three relegation dogfight games are obviously the biggest ones for yeah, any of those clubs this season. But yeah, it does promise to be a really fascinating match day for a number of reasons, doesn't it?
Yeah, obviously you've got that intrigue and everything that is going to go on at the bottom. That top of the table clash just looks a fantastic game on paper. And yeah, I think Maeda needs to get the edge on him because Damian leads on assists. So yeah, so it's up to Maeda to force the issue there in the battle for the Golden Boot. And then just elsewhere, if I'm the Yokohama FC manager, you have to pick King Kazu for the final J1 game. I expect him to start, and if he doesn't, I'll be very disappointed.
Well, yeah, surely that's it. It's got to be done, surely. Yeah, the people want it. We know that the people at Mitsuzawa want it. That's why they continue to rock up. So, yes, let's see King Kazu in the starting lineup. And well, while we're at it, let's see King Kazu Komno in the FC Tokyo starting lineup as well when Tokyo host Fukuoka. All right, so we'll finish off this episode, and yes, it's been an abbreviated part two, which you're probably thankful for, listeners, by talking about the Players of the Season awards for the next five teams that were up for discussion and indeed for voting on by our patrons at the end of last week and into the weekend. So yeah, some of them were very, very clear cut, Sam, and I think all we need to do here is basically rubber stamp the opinions of our patrons. So, well, let's begin with the top two, and indeed the two top scorers in J1 are heading into the final match day, Leandro Damião and Daizen Maeda. They each garnered huge support, as you would expect from our patrons, in the Player of the Season polls for Kawasaki and Yokohama F. Marinos. Both polls received a total of 16 votes. In the Kawasaki one, Leandro got 9 of those. Ryo Hatate, Jeziel, and Junsung Ryong were trailing behind, although I was interested to see that Hatate did actually get 4 votes of the 16. While in the F. Marinos poll, it was an absolute landslide. Of the 16 votes received, Maeda got 13 of them. And, I was amazed to see Kota Mizunuma get two of the other three. But, I think all we're doing here is just rubber stamping Leandro and Daizen Maeda as the players of the season for the top two.
Yeah, absolutely. Damian, I think, has been magnificent. His just all-round game has been terrific. I think there is no question about that for me. And same with Maeda, been magnificent for F. Marinos. I thought we'd got Mr. Mizunuma. Mr. and Mrs. Mizunuma. That's a horrible tongue twister. I thought we'd got Mr. and Mrs. Mizunuma joining us as Patreon air backers with the two votes that he got. So I was quite surprised. I mean, I don't know. He wouldn't have made my shortlist, but for two votes, well, fair play to him. And I think he'd probably need to move out of Yokohama and get some more regular football, because I think he's only started once this season, and there is a good player there. But yeah, Maeda and Damian, I think, were pretty nailed on for their respective teams.
Yes, indeed. No arguments from me. The top two scorers in the league and worthy winners. Another worthy winner, but certainly one that you would not have predicted at the start of the season, Sam, is the winner of our Kobe poll. Indeed, I don't think the bookmakers would have even given you odds on Ryuho Kikuchi winning the Kobe Player of the Season award. But of the 14 votes received in said poll, Kikuchi got 9 of them. Far outstripped bigger name teammates, more illustrious names. Andres Iniesta got 3 votes, Gotoko Sake 2, and poor old Hotaru Yamaguchi didn't even get 1 vote for his troubles. But Kikuchi, a breakout season from him, and I think all we have to do here is rubber stamp this, a worthy winner of the Kobe Player of the Season award.
Yeah, I think he is a worthy winner. He's definitely improved immensely this season. He's been magnificent, and Kobe's defence has been a lot better for it. I think, he's been magnificent. I feel bad that with 2 seasons in a row, we've denied Andres Iniesta the coveted, that this is what he really wants, to rubber stamp his career. So he's going to have to go again next season. I'm sorry, Andres. But yeah, well, fair play to Kikuchi. There's no point in trying to argue with 64% of the vote. And yeah, he's had a magnificent season, and hopefully he can go on to maybe Japanese national team next season.
Yeah, fantastic. You're just going to have to go again, Andres. We need more convincing. All right, so next to, well, now the team, let's flip the order, Sam. The team that are now in fourth heading into the final match day, Kashima Antlers. We could only stretch to 3 nominees for them, but this was another landslide result. We received 12 votes in the Kashima poll, and Ryotaro Araki, the youngster who has gotten into double figures this season in terms of goals, won 11 of the 12 votes. And the Antlers' top scorer, ISA Wader, who, as I mentioned earlier, has 14 goals for the season, he got the other vote, with Diego Pichuca not garnering any support. But Araki, we're talking about breakout seasons for Kikuchi, and Araki at the other end of the pitch has been hugely impressive for Antlers, hasn't he?
He's been absolutely magnificent, Araki. I think, he's just developed this season. He's just confident on the ball. He's got goals in him. He's got assists in him. He just loves to take on that responsibility in there. I think, I don't know how long Kashima are going to be able to hold on to him, to be honest. I imagine some European clubs will be sniffing around Araki. I think, he showed glimpses of it last season when he was breaking through. But this year, I mean, fully deserving of 92% of the vote. That's a great haul for him, and fully deserved.
Yes, indeed. And then to the team that had slipped down to 5th in the table after Saturday, of course, Nagoya Grampus, a terrific collection of names amongst their nominees. And, personally, I felt a little bit sorry for Shinosuke Nakatani, who did such a great job in central defence this year. Obviously, that's his regular position. But, he had to carry so much more of the load after club captain Yuichi Maruyama has been out since May, basically. But, Nakatani could only get 1 of the 14 votes cast, as indeed did Mateus. More votes were earned by Mitch Langerak, who got 5 of the 14. But the winner, according to our patrons, who carried 50% of the vote, was Sho Inagaki, the midfielder, who is, of course, Grampus' leading scorer in the league this year, has scored so many important goals for them, including the clincher in the Levain Cup final against Cerezo Osaka recently. So if this one is up for debate, Sam, as the Urawa one was last week, then yes, I'm going to throw my support behind Inagaki. Are you in agreement, or do you want to stake a case for Mitch Langerak here?
No, 100% Sho Inagaki. I think he's, I thought 50% was harsh to him, to be honest. I thought he's been magnificent doing everything this season. He does all the dirty work in front of the defence, which is contributing to their terrific defensive record. And he's added important goals this season. He just adds, he's got literally everything about him. I have Inagaki as up there, maybe as one or two in my player of the season for the entire league. So I have to have Inagaki as my Nagoya player of the season.
Yep, all right, nice one. So, yep, we're in agreement there. And, yes, so we've agreed with our patrons on all 5 of the clubs on this week's episode. And, Mitch, don't worry, mate, you won it last year. So, yeah, second place is nothing to sneeze at in 2021. And I'm sure you'll give it a good nudge again next season. So, yeah, that leaves the bottom 6 clubs that we still have to post polls on and get our patrons' opinions on. So they will be out sometime this week. Sam might need to give me a reminder late on in the week. But, yes, so we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. But, yeah, I have enjoyed this very much so far on the 14 clubs that we've run the rule over so far. So, yeah, basically that's all that's left for us to do this season then, is to, watch it all unfold on Saturday afternoon, match day 38, the final game of the season. And then, to see the votes of our patrons roll in on the Player of the Season awards for those final 6 clubs. And Sam, well, yes, we'll be back to round it all up, win, lose or draw next weekend. Goodness knows how it's going to shake out in the relegation dogfight. It's been pretty epic this season, hasn't it? And that's it. All we can do is just sit back and watch it unfold.
Yeah, can't wait for it. It should be a cracking day. First in J1, and then we've got madness happening in J2 and J3 the following day. So it should be a really good weekend. And just thanks to all the patrons for the engagement in all the polls. I know we've sent quite a few polls out during the last couple of weeks, but it's great to see the votes coming in for these. And yeah, good luck trying to pick players of the season from the bottom 6.
Yes, well, I think a couple of them do kind of pick themselves, don't they? But yes, it's a point well made, Sam. But by the way, we're certainly going to be keeping the patrons busy in the weeks to follow, because we've obviously got to do our team of the season as well. So that's another big batch of polls to come. But we know the patrons love them. And yes, that's why we keep pumping them out. So that's absolutely terrific. All right, so we will leave it there. That's it for this week's episode of the J-Talk podcast. Sam and I would like to thank Alan Gibson very much for his time on this week's episode. We'd like to thank Daniel, Johnny and Gab for their questions. All 3 of them are patrons of the J-Talk podcast. If you'd like to get involved, please visit patreon.com/JTalkPod. And of course, listeners, we'd like to thank you for listening wherever you are. We'll be back next week to round up all the action from the final match day of the season. Speak to you next week. Bye for now.
The J-Talk podcast.